You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. A new California law, SB 1421, is opening access to police records in the state. It's not happening necessarily quickly in some cases or even consistently from department to department, but internal affairs documents that have never been public in many cases now are. Three journalists, Nadine Sabai from CAP Radio, Suki Lewis from KQED, and Thomas Peel from the Bay Area News Group, along with a number of other associated journalists and groups, have been working collaboratively to collect and to analyze these records for the first time. The three journalists are joining me. Nadine's in the studio. Hi, Nadine.
Hi, Beth.
Suki is on the phone with us from the Bay Area. Hi, Suki. Glad to have you here.
Good morning.
And Thomas Peel is joining us by phone, too. Hi, Thomas.
Hi, good morning.
So a new investigation has been published today, and let's start there to try to understand the work you're doing and the records that are now being made available. Suki, do you want to begin with a broad outline of this current investigation and story?
Yeah, so the piece that came out this morning really looks at this kind of a couple of firings that happened in this little tiny department in the town of Rio Vista along the Sacramento River, in which internal investigations, you know, found excessive use of force in one case, you know, people being arrested without a warrant. And what was, you know, there's a number of really kind of interesting details that can be drawn out of these case files and out of these stories, but I think one thing that's really stuck with me is the case of this woman, Catherine Jenks, who was calling 911. She had called 911 repeatedly a number of times last September, and then 911, the officers who kept having to kind of respond to her calls, felt like they weren't, it wasn't an emergency and she was harassing them. And so they came up with this plan to arrest her the next time that she called. And so, you know, the story I believe that aired on your air this morning and that we have published kind of goes into, you know, what happened after they showed up to arrest her and she ended up getting, you know, really brutally bitten by a police dog. And still today, you know, months later, even though this investigation found that our officers should not have arrested her, she is still facing these misdemeanor charges and, you know, had to pay $3,300 to just to bail out of jail. Like, there are really serious kind of consequences when officers abuse their power and don't act appropriately. And I think that's what these records show.
Thomas, in your long career in investigating data and records and making requests, there was a certain way that you always had to do it with certain limitations. What's different now, and what are you finding to be working or not working, even with this new law in place?
Sure. Well, what's different now, after 40 years of secrecy on police personnel records, is that some records, not all records, of police misconduct are now open to the public, and that they involve sexual misconduct, dishonesty. If officers are disciplined for those things, they also open any use of force where a person is seriously injured, whether or not discipline is imposed. So that means that we're under the law. We are supposed to get records of every police shooting and the administrative investigative outcomes, which have never been made public. You know, when cops get fired for those things or somehow disciplined. And we're getting pushback. In Contra Costa County, seven police unions have gone to court seeking temporary restraining orders, arguing that this law is not retroactive. We have requests out going back for 5 years of records all over the state. For the most part, we're getting records. You know, we got these Rio Vista records that we reported on today. But, you know, there's some police unions, especially in Southern California, in the big counties, that are pushing back on opening these records. So very likely at some point to end up before the California Supreme Court on retroactivity.
The California Supreme Court is looking at challenges and did look at a challenge to the state law. I want to wrap this back around to, as Suki described, this particular case involving a woman named Catherine Jenks. And Nadine, that's a piece of the story that in you pursuing it shows us more than we might have known about what happens to some of the people involved, what the rest of the story is for the citizens that are part of a situation.
Definitely. I think for all of the reporters involved, when we first started looking into this case and we were reading the internal investigation documents about what happened to Catherine, it didn't seem as intense. And then we watched the body cam footage, and then it became more and more emotional. I mean, I remember watching that body cam footage maybe two or three times of Catherine Jenks being attacked by that canine dog, and I had to step outside for 20 minutes because it was so brutally intense. And then we go to Rio Vista, and we meet with Catherine Jenks and her boyfriend, David O'Reilly. And even then, it becomes more emotional, more critical. You see the consequences of police misconduct on individual humans' lives. And when it comes to Catherine Jenks, she has been emotionally torn by this. David O'Reilly, who is her her partner, said that, you know, they'll be watching TV and she'll drift off to sleep, and then she'll wake up moaning and she's dreaming about the dog biting her. And there's a part, a very powerful part at the end of this story where she says she sees the teeth. You know, those are really hard consequences. And I think that these records and being able to see these internal investigations and kind of creating that narrative of seeing this actually impacts a human's life, you know.
The story has been airing today on CAP Radio. I'm going to share a little bit of that body cam audio with a warning that it is vivid. It is intense. And there's more of it in the story posted online at capradio.org. But again, this is body cam video from the situation with Catherine Jenks.
Get him off of me.
He's not on you. He's holding on to
your foot. Oh, my God. No.
And she did end up being bitten quite severely, I understand, in her forearm. Suki, let me go back to you about the outcome for some of the officers involved, not only in this case, but there was another published report about a Burlingame police officer who was fired for asking a woman to trade sex for assistance with some of the charges. Tell me about the implications within the departments and whether these outcomes might have happened if the records weren't made public.
Well, the outcomes for most of these cases that we've gotten so far have already are already in process prior to the records being released. This last one is quite unusual. The case of the officer's name is Natalie Rafferty, who was involved in the arrest of Catherine Jenks. And she actually got her letter, discipline letter, on January 16th, where the chief said, I intend to, you know, fire you about this. But the investigation had already been completed before that. But I, you know, you do have to wonder kind of how this new law and how this new transparency around these records will kind of impact internal affairs investigations, will impact kind of how officers, you know, think about this and how they engage with the process of discipline within the department. You know, in the case of the Burlingame officer, we, you know, published about that, and the very next day, the district attorney down there in San Mateo said, we're going to take another look at that, like he potentially could face criminal charges. And I think, you know, in the case of Catherine Jenks, she had no idea that this investigation had even gone on. So I think this broader move toward transparency just has, it's going to have a bunch of consequences that we don't entirely know, but it can really also provide sunlight, which I think is a really, really important thing, and provide a window into this kind of hidden world that we haven't seen for a long time.
From KQED, that is Suki Lewis. I'm also talking with CAP Radio reporter Nadine Sabai. And a question back to Thomas Peel of the Bay Area News Group. You know, there are big stories still to be written and covered, Thomas, and there's one here in the Sacramento region that the outcome is still undecided, and that is the case of the shooting of Stephon Clark almost a year ago. Because of the new law, how does the coverage of these stories change? How do reporters approach them differently? How would you, for example?
Well, I mean, you know, if there was a officer-involved shooting today and it had to be reported on, you know, not much of the initial approach would change because the law has time frames built into it for investigations to take place. There's a companion law that allows video footage from body cams and dash cams to be released, but it has a 60-day moratorium after an event. So the initial reporting won't change much on these kinds of things. But eventually now, you know, the last step in a process will be that we'll be getting on each shooting, we should be getting the administrative investigation, which will show not necessarily a criminal act by an officer, but whether in the use of force they violated department policy. And that's what will be new.
The transparency.
Right, the transparency on the administrative end of the investigation.
How much?
For the most part, district attorneys in California release reports on officer-involved shootings, but they're only weighing the incredibly high bar of criminal charges, which almost never happen. I think the last time we had an officer charged in anything was in the Oscar Grant shooting in Oakland 10 years ago. So
I guess the question about how much latitude a department has is being fleshed out in the newness of the law and the challenges to the law to know what a department can say yes or no to and in what time frame. Let me go back to that body cam audio. Different jurisdictions have different policies on the release of it. Was that audio released to the public, what you saw, Nadine?
Well, it was released to the coalition that requested it, the series of reporters, but it is available if somebody would file a request. Those records would be available. And we were actually very surprised in how much we received. We thought that maybe we would receive documents and a couple interviews here and there, but we received the entire case file. So it was actually very surprising.
And to revisit something Suki said, you went back to Catherine Jenks and there had been minimal or no follow-up contact, and she was unaware that there was an ongoing investigation?
Yep, she had no idea. All she really seemed to know was that she had to be in court in March for trying to drop her six misdemeanor charges. And so she had no idea. And she's been emotionally affected by this, and no counseling services have been made available, no follow-up interviews, no knowledge that the officer involved, Natalie Rafferty, has been facing disciplinary action. They've been left completely in the dark about it.
We do have a bit of the questioning that happened of Officer Rafferty. This is a quick clip. You're going to first hear Internal Affairs Investigator Mark Siemens speaking to her in part of their conversation. Again, this is referencing the situation that evolved in the biting by the dog.
You say in the second paragraph, while holding Jinx's left arm, she bit my forearm, leaving teeth indentations. Mm-hmm. How painful was that bite?
It was painful.
Did it bruise?
No.
Suki, give me some context. Why is it important for people to hear pieces of that exchange?
So it was just really fascinating for me as someone who, you know, is a reporter and has never really heard inside one of these internal affairs investigations. It was really interesting to see kind of how they're done and the process of it, and also just the way someone's voice communicates something. And, you know, what she's speaking about in that exchange is when Rafferty and her partner at the time, Man Lee, were trying to arrest Catherine Jenks. She was kind of fighting back. She sits down on the ground and kind of bit them on their hands. And this was something that the investigator kind of highlighted as a distortion of truth that was put into the report later, that they had kind of trumped up these bites that she had given them and they put photos of them into, you know, the investigative report of the incident. And the investigator, Mark Seaman, said, you know, they were not injured by this woman, by her bites. Meanwhile, she was really seriously injured by the police dog. And so there's just kind of this interesting exchange where he's trying to draw out the officer and kind of see how she is representing to him the nature of these bites and how the whole thing kind of unfolded and how it came to be part of the police report of the incident.
Suki, your specialty area of reporting is criminal justice, and Thomas, your work, in fact, your Pulitzer Prize-winning work is investigative, focusing on public records and public accountability reporting. In the broader sense of what California is doing and what the movement can be across the country, do you see this as a big step forward, Thomas, that other states will be willing to boldly go toward?
Well, there are other states where these records are routinely released, Florida, Texas, elsewhere. California's been behind on this. You know, usually California is leading the country in some things and doing some things first. But because of the power of police unions, they've managed to keep a cap on this and have at least twice, I think maybe three times, defeated previous legislation to unseal these records. So California is kind of playing catch up on this, and I don't know what the impact, you know, if it's going to influence any other states. I mean, this is, you know, a fairly routine matter. When we saw that young man in Cleveland shot by the police officer a couple of years ago, the teenager who had the toy gun, I mean, records about the police officer's past, the police officer who shot that young man, I think his last name was Rice, you know, those were immediately made public in Ohio. And, you know, similar things in California wouldn't have been. So yeah, that's kind of where we are nationally on this. I'd just like to, you know, point out that one of the great ironies of the Catherine Jenks situation is that Officer Rafferty is not being fired for the dog bite itself. The dog was accidentally released. It's one of these things where the cover-up always seems to be worse than the event. And you pointed out there were these questions about where Jenks bit her, which is ironic in itself. And, you know, the internal affairs investigator called, you know, her claims that that had been a, you know, a severe bite with an injury patently false. So Rafferty is really getting, you know, is getting fired here for not following orders in the arrest of Jenks, but also for essentially fabricating a story about what happened.
She does say in your report that the button that releases the dog accidentally got bumped in the scuffle, and that's how the dog became part of it. Nadine, I want to ask you about this collaborative effort and what it takes to be able to approach a story like this, and why it's so helpful to have not only more resources, but multiple specialties in the team working on it.
Definitely. Having a lot of reporters working on a story and editors and an entire multiple news organizations working together on this makes life a lot easier for us and to allow us to do our job, which is to read depth into the documents, talk to the people that we need to talk to. It gives us that time to be able to really conduct a true investigation and to get the facts and the story of what happened. And so this collaboration has been awesome to be able to work with Tom Peel and with Suki Lewis, two reporters who are known for their criminal justice reporting, is a really great step in the right direction. And I can only hope that more news organizations get together and do these sort of projects again, because they really are very impactful and really helpful.
And I would imagine you're already into the next investigation, right, Suki, Thomas?
Well, I mean, we've got a ton of requests out, hundreds of requests. And, you know, eventually we have to catch up on all that stuff. And I think that's what we'll be doing for the next day or so. But, you know, there are larger stories that will come out of these things. We haven't gotten records from any big departments yet. And eventually we should be able to extract, once we, you know, we have the administrative results of a lot of shooting investigations, you know, we should be able to extract things that haven't been reported before. You know, how often does a person who is shot have a weapon? How often, what is that weapon? How often are those people in some kind of mental distress? You know, we hear these things anecdotally all the time. But, you know, we should be able to quantify them at some point in the future as we go through hundreds and hundreds of responsive documents.
And you're going to see discrepancies like right here in the Sacramento area where the city looks at it one way and the county looks at it very differently and is more in a position of resistance to the law or defining it in a more restricted way. So I want to thank you all for this conversation. Let everybody know that this current Rio Vista investigation is posted at capradio.org, and you can hear it this afternoon. And Suki, thank you so much. Suki Lewis from KQED, Thomas Peel from Bay Area News Group. Appreciate having you both on Insight today.
Thank you, Beth.
Thank you very much.
And Nadine Sabai is here from Cap Radio. Also, Alex Emsley from KQED is part of this collaboration that includes the investigative studios. This is Insight on Cap Radio.